Welcome to Red Leg Nation Radio, your home for discussion and analysis of Cincinnati Reds baseball all year long. Now here's your host, Chad Dotson.
Welcome to Red Leg Nation Radio, and we're happy again today to be joined by a longtime friend of Red Leg Nation Radio, Chris Welsh. Chris, thanks for being with us again. We always love when you can come on.
Well, Bill, always a pleasure to talk to you. I know you are a true baseball fan, and I love talking baseball with you.
Chris, first, we want you to pass along to your new partner, John Sadak, a welcome to Cincinnati from us. And I think he's been almost universally gotten great reviews for his enthusiasm, preparedness, and knowledge of the team. And he's really done the work before the season started, and I think it shows. And thank him for us, and tell him welcome to Cincinnati for us, would you?
I will do that. I'll point him in your direction also, because he does a lot of research, and he's always prepared. I do love his excitement and the energy that he brings to the broadcast. I thought he was a good hire. And not to say I don't miss Tom Brenneman, because I do. He was my partner for 12 years. And I don't necessarily, on board with a guy making a mistake like that and being banned for life. But you have to turn the page at some point, and I'm glad and happy now when I get a chance to work with John Sadak.
Yeah, he's been very impressive. Maybe we can get him to come on here with us sometime.
I'm sure he's available. I'm sure I'll mention something to him, and we can get that set up.
That would be great. I wanted to ask you about the changes in the TV booth this year. And Barry Larkin was brought aboard, and he's doing the home games, and you're doing some radio and that kind of things. And for those of us that are big Chris Welsh fans, that means less of what we get to hear, which is you, what we want to hear. Was that your decision? Was that made by the Reds or Fox Sports Bally's, or how did that come about?
Yeah, I don't think in the world of broadcasting, Bill, except for a few very select people, like a Marty Brenneman or Vin Scully and Bob Costas, do they ever consult the broadcaster himself and say, hey, what is the ideal thing for you to do? Usually these decisions are made elsewhere for lots of different reasons. Barry Larkin has been in the fold, the Reds fold, for a long time. And quite frankly, I'm surprised that he's such a natural fit for broadcasting that he didn't want to do this, 10 years ago. But he's been inside the Reds minor league organization as a roving instructor. He loves to give back, loves to teach kids the game of baseball. And, the opportunity for him came this year with the changes that were made with John Sadak, taking over the play-by-play. That they decided that they would bring him in as well. So he got to end up doing all the home games. I ended up doing the away games minus the 25 games that Jeff Brantley has promised on TV. And to kind of make up for that, the Reds moved me over to radio for almost 40 games, and I'm also doing about 30 games or so, right around that number, on the pre- and post-game show for the Reds TV. So for me, Bill, it's kind of a utility role, I think it's kind of exciting for me, to be honest with you. I like the way things are changed up, different doing post-game than it is doing regular game, and it certainly is different doing, radio and play-by-play on radio than I do as an analyst on TV. So it's keeping everything fresh for me.
How do you have to adjust your approach to a broadcast between the radio and TV?
Well, I prepare my scorecard in a completely different manner. When I do TV, I'm looking for things that would not duplicate what the play-by-play guy does. So I don't necessarily need a whole notebook full of batting averages and OPS and things like this. I'm looking for the outlier statistic, what the trend is, where this pitcher is throwing his breaking pitch, what is he throwing on the first pitch counts, what hitters are hitting fastballs versus hitters who are hitting cutters and sliders and curveballs and things like that. So I'm looking for more analyst stuff when I'm doing TV, maybe a little background, a story here and there. I call a lot of scouts every day, talk to scouts and people front office everywhere, and trying to get a little insight as to, what they see as well. So when I do with radio, on the other hand, it's much more black and white. I have a scorecard that has all the basic statistics on it, plus a couple of things that maybe are, for a lot of people, outliers. How much a guy strikes out versus how much he walks. Is he putting the ball in the air, things like that. But in radio, you got to keep your story short because you have to describe the action. On TV, you can tell a little bit longer story because the television describes the action.
Jumping back real quick to the changes in the booth, was there ever any talk about a three-man booth?
Yeah, there is. There was, and there will be some three-man booths. It'll be just a handful of them. And there are some other teams that do that quite a bit. The Yankees, mm-hmm. for instance, have a three-man booth almost all the time with David Cohen and Paul O'Neill and Michael Kay. It's expensive. I mean, if you're an owner or a television owner and you add one more person to that booth, you know, you've increased the cost by 33%. So
yeah.
I think that's probably one reason why you're not going to see that on a daily basis in the Reds market.
Just after listening to Barry for the first couple of weeks here, I think it'd be really interesting to hear you and he discuss your differing views on today's game.
It would be. And I think the other thing is, I worked with Barry one time already, and that was on the opening day, and I learned some things about hitting and fielding that I didn't know. So I think we come from different perspectives on the game because I have a pitching perspective and he's got a hitting and fielding perspective. I think it would be very interesting. I would relish the chance to work with him on a more regular basis.
Well, hopefully some of that will come about, and that'll be fun. Let's start talking a little baseball, though, Chris. This week, Jay Bruce retired, and I wanted to talk a little bit about Jay for a minute. And I feel kind of a sense, I don't even know what the right word is, loss or sense of ownership with Jay. But I probably saw Jay at more levels of baseball than anybody outside the Reds organization. The first time I saw him play was in the Gulf Coast League in Sarasota. And then I interviewed him in Dayton in the dugout, saw him play in High A and Sarasota. In fact, we were at the game. When he got pulled out of the game, was told he was going to Double A because he came out of the dugout to coach first base with a big smile on his face. And we were sitting right behind the dugout. We said, "You going up?" We got a big nod out of him. Then I saw him at Triple A, and I was at one of his first games and with the Reds. So I really feel attached to Jay Bruce. I don't know if that makes any sense. How would you summarize Jay's career?
He gets a Good Guy Award almost every year because he was a solid stand-up player. In a lot of ways, Jay Bruce fulfilled the promise that the Reds had for him when they drafted him high as a high school kid out of Texas. In other ways, because you saw flashes of brilliance and superstardom out of Jay Bruce, I think some fans thought that there was just a constant underachieving on the part of Jay Bruce. There was maybe just too many strikeouts. There was just not an adaptation to hit the ball the other way. But when he hit the ball, it stayed hit, and he played every day, and he was a great teammate, and I think that had I played with Jay Bruce as a player on the same team, I probably would have appreciated it much more than I would as a fan or a broadcaster, because you have a tendency as a fan and broadcaster to see more of the blemishes, and you don't see the behind-the-scenes things that balance that out. And from everybody I've ever talked to, got close to Jay and then played with him, he was a great teammate. And that's probably the best thing you can say about a player after he retires.
Well, I kind of dove into his numbers a little bit. And with the Reds, he averaged 25 home runs a season. He had a 17.3 wins above replacement in his 9 season with the Reds. His OPS plus was 110 with the Reds. He's 8th on the Reds career home run list. He was 5th in Major League Baseball in home runs in the time that he played. He's 3-time All-Star, 2-time Silver Slugger, top 10 MVP voting twice. And yet, as you just said, some people consider he was a disappointment because he was the number one minor league prospect when he came up. Unless he was the best player in baseball, do you think anybody would have ever said that he achieved what he was expected to do?
Well, it's hard. I mean, you know, when you come in with a lot of ballyhoo, sometimes no matter what you do, you're going to disappoint. And I think that was probably the case with Jay Bruce. You know, remember also when you start quoting all the home run times, you know, he was hitting in the home run era when a guy was going deep an awful lot. And it was the beginning of the time when strikeouts began to mean less and less. I mean, the cover boy for that is his teammate, Adam Dunn, who, you know, had he been born 20 years later, he would have been right in the middle of things right now as far as walk, strikeout, or home run. Bruce balanced that out because he was a tremendous defensive player. He made himself into one of the best right fielders in all of baseball. He was able to negotiate that foul line down both in Synergy Field and in Great American Ballpark where, you know, I don't think so, but I'm pretty sure that, you know, when you get down those lines, those corner outfielders have to negotiate, you know, the foul the foul lines as well as the walls behind them. And he was one of the best players at doing that. And came up with some big home runs. And I always look back on Jay Bruce's career very fondly. There were times he disappointed, maybe underachieved. But nobody hits a home run every time up.
Reds Hall of Famer, no doubt, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, he'll fill the convention center. People love Jay Bruce. He never showed his disdain with the organization on his way out the door. No name calling of the owner, no accusing ownership of favoring somebody else instead of him. I mean, he just went about his business with a smile on his face, and he was a good guy to have around.
We haven't talked in a while, so let's just talk a little bit about the Reds offseason. Dick Williams left. Nick Kroll took over and ended up wearing two hats, the general manager hat and the head of baseball operations hat. Can he do both of these jobs and do them well? And was this a baseball decision or a financial decision or a little bit of both?
You know, I don't know whose decision and why they did what they did. I know that Dick had other options in his life that were attractive to him, and I've been keeping in touch with Dick Williams, and he's very busy and very happy with what he's done. He also feels like he has his thumbprint on this ball club. That a lot of the acquisitions that the team has made, like Moustakas and Castellanos and so on, those were, he was a point man when they made those deals. So he feels like this is his ball club. And I also think that Dick Williams feels like, the changes that they've made trending towards more analytics, beefing up the number of analysts they have, the different type of specialist coaches that they have, and so on. Basically taking the team, into the 22nd century is something that he feels like he was a very important part of. So now those things that are in place, they've decided what they're going to do with their pitching. They've turned that over to Kyle Bodie and that particular philosophy on pitching. They've tried to change the way that they're teaching hitting. And so on. But now that those things are in place, I think you can do both jobs at the same time. I mean, we'll find out, but I think Nick Kroll is probably one of the busier guys in baseball. But at the same time, I wouldn't anticipate a lot of action going on as far as trades and pickups and things like that. It's a 24/7 job, but I think that he's got the people behind him to be able to handle it.
You mentioned what's going on with the pitching, and the jobs being done in terms of developing pitching in the last couple of years. I've been Reds fan for 50 years, and I've never seen the organization develop pitching like they have just in the last 2 years. What are your thoughts on Derek Johnson and Kyle Bodie and what they've done with the pitching in the organization? Is it as revolutionary as it seems to us on the outside, or were the Reds so far behind that now they're just doing what everybody else is doing?
Well, first things first, to Derek Johnson. I mean, you have to have a good communicator who understands people and understands pitching in order to take all the scientific data that you have accumulated and teach a pitcher how to actually do something. I mean, listen, the same guys that are on the mound are not the guys, in the back room, with algorithms in front of them, okay? So somebody has to figure out how to do that, and I think that's where Derek Johnson comes in. He's probably the single most important uniform person in the Reds organization, because he's responsible for more than just one pitcher. He's responsible for all of them, ultimately. The Reds, I guess they were behind, but at the same time, I'm a believer that there has to be a blend. There has to be a blend of the analytics and the data that you get to help pitchers along the way. But what the Reds have done is really remarkable as far as their commitment to this stuff. Pitchers need help all the time in improving their pitches. Well, they've got a data set on how to help a pitcher do that now. They never had that before. They have a whole strategy on how to get pitchers, get them to throw harder. And it's not an experiment. They're using strategies and protocols that actually work. Underload training, overload training, and so on. And it goes all the way down to the minor leagues. So I like really what they've done as far as the adaptation of it. But at the same time, you have to keep in mind that, while you learn how to throw a faster fastball and a better shaped breaking ball and a higher spin rate curveball, somebody, and the analyst can tell me how to do that. But somebody has to teach this 19 and 20-year-old kid how to pitch. How does that kid pitch and survive on a night when he doesn't have that good fastball? How does that kid understand what it takes to deliver a pitch under pressure with the game on the line, on the road, when he's got 20,000 people screaming at him? So those are the things that are the human side of baseball and human side of pitching that you just can't forget about. And to do so would only build half a pitcher.
Speaking of Derek Johnson, do you know anything about his contract situation, how much time he has left, anything like that?
I do not. I'm sorry, I don't.
How important do you think it is that they do everything they can to keep him?
I think he's the most important person in the Reds uniform.
Yeah.
you know, to compare him to maybe who you think may be the most important player, okay, and then compare the two salaries, you kind of come up with your own answer.
Yeah. Going into this season, I don't think anybody could say that this team had a stronger roster than last year, losing Bauer and Iglesias and Bradley. And I guess maybe if Senzel stays healthy and Akiyama continues to improve, you might be able to say it. But what's your biggest concern about this team?
Well, they had gaping holes to fill. I mean, they traded away supposedly their best arm in Iglesias, didn't get anything in return. That was a money deal. Lost Trevor Bauer. If Iglesias isn't your best arm, then Bauer is. And what he's doing in L.A. is really interesting to watch. The one thing that they have going for them this year is the intangible of a full season in the clubhouse with some leadership, finally. This is the one thing that the Reds have lacked for so long. There's been so much emphasis on what a player can do on the stat page that they have forgotten all about what leadership is. And when Castellanos flexes muscles in the Cardinal game, and when Moustakas calls for players-only meetings in the clubhouse, those are the kind of leaders that the Reds have needed for a long time. And, some people say, well, you got to go all the way back to 1999 and Greg Vaughn and Lenny Harris and Barry Larkin, you know, to have that kind of leadership. And I would agree. You've got to have it in the clubhouse. You've got to play with an edge. And Castellanos does that. Naquin brings that. And I think it's helped Senzel a little bit, coming out of his shell a little bit. And I think that, that now you have India, who kind of plays like a little bit of a grinder. He looks around and says, hey, I got to play like this too. And the other guy who I really see the difference in between this year and 2019 is Jesse Winker. I think his attitude on the field, his body language, is completely different than it was in 2019. And all for the better.
Okay. What has anything surprised you about this team in the first 3 weeks?
They're hitting a lot better than I thought they could. Doesn't mean they're going to hit all year long, but what's really surprised me is how athletic Tyler Naquin is. I always heard he was a really good player, one time a really top prospect, always had some injuries that held him back. But that has been a nice surprise. How Votto is able to hit a fastball this year is a nice surprise as well. He looks confident at the plate. His bat-to-ball swing is uncanny. He's really, really good, and I'm looking for this offense to continue to chug right along.
I think so far this year, the story of the big story for the Reds is Jonathan India. I mean, the kid went from being a long shot to even making the team to opening a season at second base. What have you seen out of him that's impressed you? I know he struggled after the first week, but tell me what you see in Jonathan India.
I like the way he plays the game. He's engaged in the game. He's engaged in those spring training games, which is sometimes hard to do. The word I get from – now, remember, I don't get to watch this guy practice, except for batting practice. In the spring training, we weren't even allowed on the premises down there where the workout center is. So all I saw was him in games. But, talking to a lot of the scouts, not only Reds people, but other people, I mean, they just really like the way he plays the game. And I think, and he's athletic. He runs maybe a click above average. He doesn't have really the arm to play third base. They put him in a solid spot in second. And he gets along with his teammates. And I think he, come back again, plays the game the right way. You can't get enough of those guys.
I'm going to kind of bridge from Jonathan India to Suarez here in the shortstop position, and I give Suarez all the kudos in the world for moving to short to help the team. But boy, he's been bad defensively, and I have to wonder, and I guess I'm asking, how much of India at second base was due to his really good spring and what he showed last year apparently out at the Ketchup Factory, and how much of it was Suarez moving to shortstop and them just moving things around to get more offense in the team on the field.
Well, I never really felt that the Reds were comfortable having Stockton at second base. So they were trying to figure out a way to get, you know, him over to third, which is his more natural position. But you already have Suarez there, so what are you supposed to do, right? You know, Suarez is up to 10, 15 pounds lighter, and looks like a shortstop, acts like a shortstop. So, hey, let's move him to shortstop. That solves the shortstop problem. And they had a major problem, okay? I just don't think that Kyle Farmer is best suited on this ball club as the number one shortstop day in and day out. So they were able to rectify that problem. And you know, all these changes, you know, you help Peter and you say Paul, that kind of thing. So, you know, you have to maybe put up a little bit of a blip in defense with Suarez as shortstop because he hasn't been there. He may not be the true shortstop that you're looking for. He certainly is no Lindor. But at the same time, he's a threat. And supposedly now, defensively, you're putting these players where they're going to hit the ball. And, you know, rarer and rarer do you see a great shortstop play. You used to see a great shortstop play once a game. Now you see it once a week. So maybe the defense isn't as important as you thought.
There's been a lot of talk about the Reds' outfield, especially with Naquin getting off to a good start and how effective Aquino was before he got hurt. And Akiyama's back in early May, and somebody's going to have to go, aren't they? They're not going to carry six outfielders, I wouldn't think. Would you?
No, but it's funny how things tend to take care of themselves, don't you? I mean, just as Akiyama begins to get healthy, here you have Aquino goes on the DL with a hamate bone surgery. So, you know, that's why ball clubs have to be patient. I think I heard a term one time, excruciatingly patient, with their young players coming up and also with their roster decisions. But the way the roster is right now, I don't see a lot of room in playing time for, you know, Akiyama. And as good as he was towards the end of the year last year, and he's got used to the speed of the game, and I like watching him play, and he plays fundamentally terrific baseball, throws to the right base, in the right place at the right time. But I don't know who he plays ahead of. He doesn't play ahead of Winker. He doesn't play ahead of Senzel, Castellanos, or Naquin. So, yeah, the Reds are going to have to eventually make some roster decisions, but, you know, those seem to take care of themselves.
And none of these guys that we're talking about that might be a possibility in the outfield are going down. I don't see any of them getting through waivers, do you?
Well, I don't know that. If the demand would be for, you know, Aquino, for instance. I love Eric Jennings to death, but other than that first month that he had, I mean, I hope this guy needs a little better plan at the plate.
Yeah.
Strategy is terrible. I mean, how many times have we seen him take a fastball down the middle and then strike out and pitch to the dirt? So maybe it's repetition for him. Maybe he's too young to be a bench player. Maybe moving him to a different organization would be better in the long run for him and maybe even for the Reds. I don't know. But right now, he doesn't play in front of the guys you have.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about pitching. Michael Lorenzen got put on the 60-day and isn't expected back till sometime in June. Do you think that means he's in the bullpen the rest of the year?
I don't know what it means. I just want to get him healthy. He's a great talent. And, you know, shoulder issues are those that you don't hear really much about anymore because teams have figured out a way to make sure that, pitchers strengthen their shoulders and they basically eliminate a lot of the issues that happened back, you know, in the 70s and the 80s before, you know, pitchers were conditioned the way they are. So, get him healthy first. I imagine that he probably will start the season in the bullpen. But again, you know, as I said, things have a way of taking care of themselves. You don't know what's going to happen here. Are the pitchers that you have healthy right now going to be healthy all year long? Everybody's keeping their fingers crossed now.
Luis Castillo struggled again last night early. Are you worried at all about him?
I'm not. I think you got to get back to basics for Castillo. I mean, even when he struggles, I see a guy throwing 97 with the best changeup around. Okay, so what I'm seeing is, let's get back to basics here, Luis, okay? Let's start, instead of the numbers like 97 and what your spin rate is, what the difference between changeup and fastball is, how about these numbers? How about first pitch strikes? How about first two pitches in the strike zone out of the first three that you throw? How about the pace of the play, getting the ball and throwing it in 15 seconds or less, where you command the attention of the hitter on the field? Those are the kind of numbers that I want to see. At the end of the game, if Luis Castillo starts just getting back to basics, he's going to be fine. I'm not worried one bit. I think by the end of the season, you're going to look back on this and say, well, he got off to a tough start, but he finished strong.
TJ Anton's been an amazing story ever since last year. Do you think the Reds are making the best use of him in the bullpen?
Yeah, I think they are right now. I think that's kind of it's how you word that question, Bill. Are the Reds making the best use of their pitching staff with him in the bullpen, rather than are they making the best use of TJ Anton? My responsibility as the guy that runs the pitching on that team, if it were me, I'd answer the first question, not the second question, because I could care less what I'm doing personally for these guys. I want to do the best for the team. And right now, I think he serves a very needed spot in the bullpen. These guys aren't going 7 or 8 innings anymore, okay?
Right.
So you got your starters that are going 4 and 5 innings. You better have somebody who can give you 2 or 3 in the middle of the game, and he is every bit as important as a starter. So that's why I like Anton where he is. I like what he's done. I think he's falling in love with his breaking pitch a little bit too much over the last few times out, but I think he'll get back to basics too.
Amir Garrett has really struggled since the season started. How much of that do you think was his limited spring training, or how much of it do you think is what looks to me be like natural inconsistency, or is it some of both?
Well, it's deliberate. Anytime you're a big, tall guy, and Garrett's close to 6 feet 7 inches tall, little things that go awry in delivery are magnified at home plate. Look how long it took Randy Johnson to finally figure it all out, right? So, Amir Garrett has a very fast beat of balance, meaning his internal clock is quick. So when he starts that delivery, he's really fast, and sometimes he gets just a little bit out of sync. He's still, in my book, he's got one of the best sliders in baseball. I'm not worried about Garrett, but he's got to find something in his delivery that kind of keeps it all together. To smooth out, even if he doesn't smooth out his delivery physically, mentally he's got to smooth out his delivery so that he can repeat. And once he starts repeating, he's as good as there is. And I think it does come back to spring training. He was injured for the first part of spring training. He didn't get very many innings. And in the long run of this ball game this year, the Reds have to be very careful how much they use Garrett, because you want him healthy all year long.
As we start to wrap up here, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on the Castillo suspension and Major League Baseball's ruling on it.
Well, I don't know. It seems like every year they've got a different guy handing out the penalties to Major League Baseball. 2 years ago and beyond that, it was Joe Torre. Last year and a half or so, it was Chris Young, who's now the general manager in Texas. Now it's Michael Hill, former general manager, Cincinnati guy, but he was a GM down in Florida for the Marlins for a long time. And he's a good baseball guy. I know Michael. But it seems like every one of these enforcers wants to put their thumbprint on the new way that we're going to do things. And I do know this. Baseball does not have any room for fighting on the field or, beanball wars. So I think it's just kind of a warning shot to everybody out there that, let's just play the game. I thought it was an unfair suspension in the very first place. I don't think he did anything to get suspended for it. He didn't cause a fight. He didn't hit anybody. He didn't charge the mound. He didn't throw his equipment at anybody. I mean, he jumped up and had an emotional reaction of flexing over the pitcher. Pitcher got his feelings hurt, and he gets a 2-game suspension. I don't like it at all, but at the same time, what are you going to do about it? Serve your 2 games and get back there and take it out on the next team you play.
as we're wrapping up here, what are the keys of the things? The Reds are a few percentage points in front of the Brewers as we go into picking up a suspended game today. And what should we watch to see for this team to be successful as we move on?
Well, I think you're going to need to see Nick Senzel have a good year. And I think you're going to need to see Suarez begin to get back to basics again and put the bat on the ball. The thing that scared me about Suarez at the beginning of the year is that he says he wants to hit 50 home runs. Well, anybody who says they want to hit home runs when they go to the plate, rarely do they ever do that. Usually, take me back to the days of Tony Perez saying, I want to hit the ball hard, and then the home runs will take care of themselves. And I think that will be the case with those guys. The health of their pitching staff is very important. You can't lose Sonny Gray for an extended period of time. Hopefully his back's going to hold up. But overall, I think, can the bullpen throw enough strikes? This is the key for me. You got to have a strong bullpen, and you have to have a lot of depth in the minor leagues, because as you see more and more innings being piled on the bullpen, and we're only in April now, but when you get to July and August, and now your bullpeners have, had 40 appearances, and they're beginning to get tired because they didn't get stretched out last year. Some of them didn't even play. This is where you're going to need a lot of arms. And I think that the Reds will eventually see, we're going to eventually see some of these big-time prospects that we've been looking for. I'm looking for a year that maybe later in the season we see a Nick Lodolo or Hunter Green or maybe one of the other phenoms that are coming up through the organization, because ball clubs are going to need arms, plenty of them.
Yeah, and assuming the bullpen stays healthy and we need to do that rotation, though, they're kind of in a problem, though, because I think Perez is and De Leon are the only guys with options. So unless somebody went on the DL, they're going to be kind of grinding as to find ways to make that rotation to bring guys from Louisville up to supplement the bullpen, don't you think?
Well, yeah, but that's kind of the point I made, is that you're going to see some injuries and you're going to see some guys that just need 10 days off. So you put them on the injured list. I really think that, this is uncharted waters for a lot of teams out there right now with their pitchers. How deep the Athletics start to go into the game? How is it okay to pitch in April? Do you want to skip over them in the rotation? Or do you want to bump them up a five pitcher when you have an off day? These are the kind of things that really nobody knows the answer to right now. But I think if you have pitchers who can pitch rather than pitchers who can throw, it's going to give you an advantage. And if you have plenty of good arms in the minor leagues and in the alternative site or the alternate site, you're going to be able to survive what's going to be a tough summer.
Chris, I always want to ask you about the Baseball Rules Academy, because I look forward to the emails that I get from them, because it always teaches me something I don't know. So what's going on at the Baseball Rules Academy these days?
Well, really a lot of things, Bill. We're trying to put together a series of rules, of animated rules, that we can show on television and also show on the scoreboard, where we don't violate any MLB video rights and so on. But I think knowing the rules is important. I'm still flabbergasted that a baseball team will spend millions of dollars on analysts and so that they can know everybody's spin rate and things like that, when they got players walking around and don't know some of the simple rules that you win or lose a ball anymore. In a season. I think that they should be coached better in that way. My website is meant for fans, coaches, and players, and umpires' offices as well. And I have a good time doing it, and that's my main motivation. It's free to get on. You get a certain number of articles every month before you have to pay. It's something that I enjoy, and I've learned a lot along the way. I don't know every rule. I'm still fumbling around looking for rules. Last night it was a suspended game. I wanted to make sure we had that right. It's kind of a labor of love for me that I never thought I'd be that into it, but now that I am, I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, you had one this week that I didn't know, that about running out of the baseline when they weren't attempting to tag you, where a guy made a big loop coming between third and home to affect the throw to the plate, and I didn't know that rule. I assumed he was out of the baseline. He's out, and.
Yeah. The runner doesn't establish a baseline until the fielder is making an attempt to play on him. And one slight rule change over the last few years on that particular rule is that a fielder knows no longer has to lunge at the runner. All he has to do is make a move to that runner. And at that point, the runner has 3 feet in which to try to elude the tag, and if the umpire feels like he goes out of the baseline, he's out. So it's a lot easier on the fielders now without having to lunge. But, I mean, you know, take a survey of big league players. Do they know that they no longer have to lunge at them? No. I mean, I'm looking at a guy the other day who was a fielder who went lunging at him. And the reason that the baseball has changed that is that they don't want the defensive team to be penalized by a fielder chasing somebody out of the baseline and then not having the opportunity to start a double play. So I think it's a good rule, but there's all little nuances that have changed like that. And I think that, you know, I sent out one yesterday, I don't know if you got it, about a runner being hit by a batted ball. I mean, the myth in baseball is if you're hit by a batted ball, you're automatically out, right? Fair batted ball. Well, that's not always the case. It depends where the fielders are. Depends where they have if it deflects off the pitcher. So there's a lot of different circumstances that, you know, you may know and I may know, but I can guarantee you that, you know, 70% of the players in that clubhouse, they don't know. And I always think the baseball team should spend a little bit more time teaching the players about the rules.
Well, Chris, I always enjoy the time I spend talking baseball with you, and I want to thank you again for your time. And I always learn something when we talk, and I appreciate that very much. And I hope we can get together maybe later in the season.
You let me know anytime, Bill. Always happy to be on a podcast with you. Remember, that was baseballrulesacademy.com. I know you're a big supporter, but I appreciate that. And, you know, we're getting about 4,000 people a day on that site. So it's beginning to get some traction, and we're having a little bit of fun.
That's great. Oh, Chris, and Linda says hello.
Okay. And I'll look forward to your next call, Bill.
Okay, brother. Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Red Leg Nation Radio from redlegnation.com. Subscribe to Red Leg Nation Radio on iTunes or through your favorite podcast app. And join us for discussion of all things Reds at redlegnation.com. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.